this podcast, I'm going to read Chapter 5 from Comets, Visitors from Deep Space by David Escher. A really great, great read, published in 2013. For me, it sort of starts off with the naming convention of comets, which is really quite fascinating because it's explained and you have to read back to reorder it. It's sort of like there's no table there, it's written in text, and you have to decipher and check that you understand it. Then it goes through comet after comet, which is it's got the interest, but it's got the same structure for each comet. Appears, someone observes it, and something happens, and then it dies away. It goes across. By chapter 5, it comes to comets in human culture. There's a bit of a discussion about comets as snowballs. I like it as a char-grilled cosmic potato. And you've got the various orbits, the Jovian orbits, Jupiter to, or Saturn to Neptune orbits in the planets, and then you've got the Oort clouds, and the Oort cloud is pretty amazing. That's when you all add up, that's 30 solar masses according to this book, and 20,000 to 50,000 AU astronomical units. That's a good fraction of the way to our nearest star. That's almost a light year, or half a light year out. No, a light year out into space. These comets come in from time to time. It's a pretty amazing stuff to hear the structure of it. There's also other interesting things which are not fully explained. For me, I'm always interested in the green glowing comets, which are the Carpen-Dama comets. This is C2 glowing, and that's a very interesting chemical to look at. I wish it was explained more. There's things like the dust tail and the iron tail, something called the anti-tail. I must admit, I've read the book and these terms are not clearly explained, but we're going to do Comets in Human Culture, Chapter 5, and this is sort of like a sleeping gem in this book. This is where, if you ever had any scientist you respected, it's sort of like this blooper file of scientists coming up with crazy theories. I was thinking, you know, it was been data dumped to my head. I thought, look, I can give a talk about this. But really, it doesn't do justice. It really has to be, it's so well written, and there's so much detail in it that you really have to listen to it. It's like if you listen to a highlight, that's a highlight, but it's sort of like showing you the tip of a mountain without the actual mountain range. So you can hear opposite. I'm sitting in a chair on my patio. Opposite me is a school. They're making a lot of noise. I'm doing cardiac rehab. I may have to stop when my wife comes home from Pilates. Okay, Chapter 5, Comets in Human Culture. Oh, just before I go, this is cardiac rehab to make sure that I can speak coherently, read coherently, and speak in class. Comets have always been afforded special place in the minds of human beings. In fact, from the earliest days of recorded history up to the 17th century, most people thought they were harbingers of doom or portents of some incredible important events, perhaps good but usually bad. Thought to be spectres from beyond, ghosts sent from the heavens or hell, and carrying wickedness or good, comets spent the entire history of human culture being misunderstood until just the last 300 years. And the real understanding of comets, as we've seen, has only developed over the past century. It's difficult to blame the ancients for singling out comets, as so few things in the sky seem to change over short time intervals. To most, the sky is filled with stars, seems essentially static. Even the motion of planets, the moon, the sun, are comfortable. But comets are outside the realm of comfortable, and their uninvited sudden appearances would shake the foundations of beliefs. Now, I just love the way they go through this. This is one of my favourite, I call it a dud philosopher. I think he's such a lightweight philosopher. The Roman philosopher Lucius Annaeus Seneca, a.k.a. Seneca the Younger, 4 BC to 65 AD summarized the early take on comets as opposed to the always visible parts of the heaven, the sun, the moon, and so on, in one of his writings. No man is so utterly dull and obtuse, he penned, well, with his head so bent on earth, as never to lift himself up and rise with all his soul to the contemplation of the starry heavens, especially when some fresh wonder shows a beacon light in the sky. As long as the ordinary course of the heaven runs on, custom robs it of its real size. Such is our constitution that objects of daily occurrence pass as unnoticed, even when most worthy of our admiration. On the other hand, the sight, even of trifling things, is attractive if their appearance is unusual. So this concourse of stars, which paints with beauty the spacious filament high, gathers no concourse of the nation. But when there is any change in the wanted order, then all eyes are turned to the sky. So natural it is to admire that what is strange rather than what is great. Actually quite sort of an interesting thing. It's not a very deep, it's more a commentary than a philosophy. The same thing holds in regard to comets, continued Seneca. If one of these infrequent fires of unusual shape has made its appearance, everybody is eager to know what it is. Blind to all other celestial bodies, each asks about a newcomer. One is not quite sure whether to admire it or fear it. Persons there are who seek to inspire terror by forecasting its grave import, and so people keep asking and wishing to know whether it is a portent or star. The first organized thoughts about comets in the analytical sense grew out of the work of the associations of Greek philosopher Aristotle, 384 BC to 322 BC, when we were counting down, a student of Plato and a teacher of Alexander the Great. In his Metallurgy, Aristotle laid down his views about the geological sciences. Not only did he define the four basic elements, fire, water, earth, air and earth, he also discussed weather phenomena. Okay, he actually had a fifth element there called ether, and this is cosmic ether. Earthquakes and the physics of moving bodies, hydrology and comets. His text is also valuable as a review of the previous ideas about comets, which he summarily dismissed. So that's an interesting thing. Aristotle reviewed the notion of Greek philosopher Pythagoras of Samos, 750 to 495 BC, 100 years earlier, creator of the Pythagorean theorem, who fancied the motions of celestial bodies following elegant curves held in the highest reference to the form of a circle. Okay. Celestial spheres, harmonics of spheres, but that's not quite exactly. The notion subsisted until Kepler's law of planetary motion came along in the 17th century. Aristotle summarized how Pythagoras and his followers believed that only one great comet existed and all sightings of comets represented seeing the same object at different places at different times as it rose a short distance above the horizon. The story was very different according to the Greek mathematician Hippocrates of Chios, 470 to 410 BC, who supposed that the comet formed its tail by drawing water vapour from the earth. The visibility of the comet's tail, he further believed, was dependent on the humidity of the region from which the comet was being viewed. And even more strangely, Greek philosopher Anaxagoras of Clazomenae, 500 BC to 428 BC, along with his compatriot philosopher Democritus of Abdera, surmised that comets were formed by the conjunction of planets approaching each other in the sky and therefore appearing to contact, causing unusual phenomena like tails. Dismantling the previous notions, Aristotle then laid forth his own ideas. Obviously, it's going to be a much better idea in the important work of metrology. and they were incredibly influential as Aristotle's concepts and ideas formed the architectural basis of many scientific thoughts for centuries. According to Aristotle, the notion that comets grew out of his celestial spheres containing the basic forms of matter, which were concentric and ordered in density, the densest earth lay in the centre. Then came water, which was dense, but also heavy and relatively cold, like Earth. Next, the airy sphere, and above it, the fiery sphere, which didn't consist of flames, but objects laden with potential fire, for fire. The distant storehouse contained flammable materials that, if agitated, would ignite and cause luminous phenomena. He later added the fifth element, ether or quintessence, to be the atmosphere, a changeless region that moved about in circles. In the celestial universe of Aristotle's, comets formed when the sun or even planets warmed the Earth, thus causing warm, dry emissions from places on Earth to evaporate and rise upwards. Simultaneously, cool, moist air evaporated and similarly rose upwards. The cool, moist air interacted with the warmer air rising through it, and at the border of the fiery sphere, friction between the two columns ignited them, producing a comet. The comet's motion and behaviour in the sky depended on the nature and the amounts of emissions from below. So, Aristotle, go for it. He believed that comets were actually rocks heated from the ground which rose up. Aristotle believed that comets foreshadowed atmospheric events on Earth, like winds, droughts, reflecting those conditions under which they are formed. Despite this adherence to promoting comets as local atmospheric phenomena, Aristotle proposed rational ideas based on large amounts of empirical observations. It turned out to be simply wrong, but the basic idea of what Aristotle believed about comets lived for many hundreds of years, longer than the cosmos of concentric spheres and circular orbits, he believed in, which was soon smashed by more sophisticated ideas of ecliptic orbits by the Greco-Roman mathematician of Claudius Ptolemy. Okay, so he's the epicentral person. So he's the person who's going to blow Aristotle out of the water. So he said they're on spheres, but the planets themselves orbit on mini spheres. In the Roman world, more than 300 years after Aristotle's death, Seneca wrote about comets, which was and much more in his famous work Natural Questions, written about the year 63. And he wrote about them under considerable pressure from Emperor Nero, who began his life of wretched excess, total immorality and criminality, and who had already arranged for the deaths of his mother, his wife and stepbrother. Spectacular stuff. Seneca was the main front man who had to front up to everyone and explain it all away. An imperial advisor, Seneca, was accused of embezzlement and wrote in a style of badly flattering the emperor. Wanted to do this suicide, so Seneca had this famous suicide. He was so fat, the suicide didn't work. It's pretty amazing. Seneca mentioned recent comments, recalling, quote, one which appeared during the reign of Nero Caesar, which has redeemed comets from their bad character. He later referred to the recent one which he saw during the joyous reign of Nero. That flattery worked only for a short time. Accused of complicity in the Pisan conspiracy, a plot to kill Nero, Seneca was forced to commit suicide. Nonetheless, his writings about comets published in Natural Questions continued to influence the thinking about celestial visitors for years to come. So he sort of was... He was talking about comets, but he was really trying to get his boss out of riots. So, wouldn't you know, people wanting to riot, a comet came up, and they thought, well, this is an excuse for a riot revolution, this comet. But Seneca was there to say, oh, maybe, let's think about it a bit more. Seneca believed that comets were not fiery apparitions, but permanent creations of the natural world that last and have been seen for short periods because of their movements. He mentioned the observation of comets during a solar eclipse, and therefore believed many comets may move close to the sun in the skies but be hidden by its glare. Impressively, Seneca proposed that comets move in circular orbits and travel around the sky, becoming invisible when they move behind planets. One of the chief arguments for comets being atmospheric and not distant celestial bodies was, in fact, their appearance and motion differed greatly from those of the stars and planets. For this, however, Seneca had a rational retort. Nature does not turn out her work according to a single pattern, he wrote. She prides herself upon her power of variation. She does not often display comets. She has assigned them a different place, different periods from other stars, and motions like theirs. She wished to enhance the greatness of her work by these strange visitants whose form is too beautiful to be accidental. Okay, I can read a bit more. Seneca then looked forward to the distant future. So, okay, he's more, not a philosopher, he's more a, let's put a break on rational thought or irrational thought. Seneca looked forward to the distant future, realizing that the understanding would deepen over the ages. The day will come yet when posterity will be amazed what we remained ignorant of things that will to them seem so plain. Men someday will be able to demonstrate in what regions comets have their paths, why their course is so far removed from other stars, what is their size and constitution. This is pretty amazing stuff from Seneca, my craziest philosopher I've ever come across. To be satisfied that we have discovered and leave a little truth for our descendants to find out. As Roman philosophers went, Seneca was an impressive scientist in the making. Okay, he stood up for careful analytical observations, and even though his conclusions were primitive, the analytical components was a big step forward. In fact, his belief in the periodic orbiting of comets caught on finally with Edmund Halley more than 16 centuries later after Seneca's death. During Seneca's lifetime, however, another Roman influenced contemporary thinking on comets. The philosopher and author Gallus Plinius Secundus, better known as Pliny the Elder, was a close friend of the Emperor Vespasian. He's a real interesting person. A prolific writer, like I'm a prolific podcaster, Pliny the Elder wrote numerous books and had many adventures before dying in a rescue operation during the famous eruption of Mount Vesuvius that overwhelmed the Pompeii and Herculaneum, or just Pompeii. Pliny the Elder's last work in natural history, written in 37 books and completed near the end of his life. It's also Pliny's only work to have survived. The book treats botany, zoology, meteorology, mineralogy, and other assorted topics, including comets, i.e. it was sort of an ancient Wikipedia. It was just a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant read. Okay. Pliny's scope was far-reaching. He told others he wanted to compile a book that would provide general description of everything that is known to exist through the Earth. Hooray for modest goals. Because the work is so voluminous, its influence spread across the globe and lasted deep into the Middle Ages. But Pliny gathered all matter of information for his work, perhaps driven by sheer heft, including necessical superstition, pseudoscience, incantation, and the magic spells. The book has a well-balanced ideas of the day. Leaning heavily on Aristotle, Pliny completely ignored Seneca and his modern views of comets. Instead, he delivered a barrage of stream-of-consciousness facts, sometimes in a contradictory fashion. Pliny wrote that some comets moved and others don't. He suggested that they could show up anywhere in the sky, but the ones in the south that lacked a tail. He recorded the longest and shortest apparition of comet of the sky were 80 days and 7 days. He suggested that comets were most oftenly observed in the northern sky, often associated with the glow of the Milky Way. Pulling backwards against reason, he fully supported the idea that comets were portents of doom and even provided something of a user's guide to determining what types of horrifying events could be presaged. According to the amazing conclusion, Pliny was a list of 10 types of cometary visitors. 1. I'm going to try and give it the Latin name Pogonatus, a comet with a beard or a mane of hair hanging down. 2. Aconteus, a comet vibrating like a javelin with a fast motion. 3. Xiphas, Xiphas, a comet with a short, pointy form like a dagger. Discus, a disc-shaped comet. Plethus, a comet shaped like a cask, emitting hazy light. Acratus, a comet with the appearance of a horn. A Lampadus, a comet appearing like a flaming torch. A Hipparus, a comet shaped like a horse's mane being blown into the air. An Arcanatus, a silver-covered comet with a great luminosity. A Hicus, a comet influenced by goats and characterized by goat-like ruffs of hair. There's all 10. Pliny the Elder was not a scientist, but rather a collector of information, good, bad, and different. His hodgepodge of commentary facts included some glimpses of interest and truth also, even in the context of the time, a large helping of utter nonsense. Others desperately needed to come along to help refine a more realistic view of comets as a human being saw them. And that takes us back to Claudius Ptolemy, perhaps the last great free-thinking astronomers of the ancient world. Go Ptolemy, I'm really hoping for him something. Ptolemy was steeped in intellectual vibrancy of Alexandria, that's a port at the mouth of the Nile. Ptolemy is still best known for his masterwork, Almagest, a complex book containing his views about the apparent motion of stars and planets. The text was completed in early 150. Ptolemy hypothesized epicycles changed the thinking about bodies moving around the cosmos. And the interesting thing is that the orbit. So the epicycle is an orbit around a point on another circle, but the Earth is not on the center of that circle. So an interesting thing to actually get it right. He believed planets and other bodies moved in epicycles, small circles, the center of which form a larger circular motion around a body like the Sun. So as the smaller bodies orbit the larger one, it makes little circular loops as it moves around the larger one in a generally circular way. The idea worked ingeniously so accurately that it lasted until Johannes Kepler arrived in his more sophisticated and accurate ellipses in the 17th century. Because of the apparent leap forward, Almagest was incredibly influential for centuries. Ptolemy also penned Terribilis, a company work on astrological themes and earthly effects of astronomical bodies. Ptolemy left comets for a companion volume, considering them astrological bodies. Thus, accomplished as his orbital mechanics were, Ptolemy considered comets signs of doom, war, deaths of leaders, and other nonsense. In fact, he took the notion so seriously that he specified examples that could be used as a kind of guide. A comet's shape, he wrote, determined the nature of the impending horrific event that would be stricken. The area of the sky where the comet appeared and the tail perceived direction dictated where on Earth the doomsday scenario would play out. So, I don't know if you're a scientist, these people are really great people, not Seneca, but Ptolemy, you know, it's a bit depressing. If the comet appeared suddenly near the sun in the sky, then the terror might happen quickly. If the comet appeared away from the sun, more time might be ticked away before the comet's ill effect. And the amount of time that the comet lingered in the heavens could determine how long the terrible events would go down here on Earth. A work that followed and was reprinted many times throughout the Middle Ages was Cinquilium, and erroneously attributed to Ptolemy. The work contained hundreds of aphorisms about astrology, and was first seen widely in the 10th century. A version containing a commentary by the Egyptian mathematician Ahmed ibn Yusuf, 835 to 912. Among other astrological rules and regulations, the work contains specific rules for comet-related disasters. So, again, this is one thing you pick up. This region in the Dark Ages is full of frauds. There's no quality control, and so Ptolemy has this stuck on him. One, the appearance of a comet at the cardinal point, 11 astronomical signs from the sun, implied the kingdom's sovereign, or perhaps the usurped prince, would soon die. Two, the appearance of the comet in a succeeding house signalled prosperity for the kingdom's treasury, but a change in the ruling monarch. Three, the appearance of a comet in a cadent house, one that has passed the meridian, meant death and disease. If the comet moved from west to east, the country or region would be invaded by an enemy. A stationary comet meant the enemy would emerge from within, from the country itself. I'd just love it. With the dissolution of Greek and Roman dominance, the entry of the world into a thrilling period known as the Middle Ages, progresses on revising views of comets were slow. Dominated by the church, free thinking stifled by dogmatically looking backwards instead of forward. That is a good way of describing scholasticism. The medieval period delivered a gloomy forecast for the progress of any of the sciences. One of the earliest medieval astronomers was the English monk Bede the Venerable, who lived and worked at two monasteries in modern-day Jarrow and Northumbrian. This intellectual for his time believed that comets signalled wars, disease, change in rules, heat waves and fearsome winds. Like his predecessors, Ptolemy, Bede laid down a hard, fast rules about comets and their behaviours. I just love it doing this. He claimed that some moved like plants while others did not move at all. They nearly always appeared in the northern sky and usually were placed near the Milky Way. He repeated the exact periods of visibility given so many years before by Ptolemy. Others joined the fray. The German Dominican friar Bishop Albert Magnus believed that comets were terrestrial vapours emanated from lower spheres to the terrestrial region to the boundary of the fiery sphere. Aristotle is still alive and going, where they became visible. A comet's visibility was dependent on the amount of fuel it contained, and when it burnt out, the comet disappeared. Magnus believed comets were symbols of terrible, important events and not their causes. One of Magnus's students was none other than the English philosopher Roger Bacon. Okay, 1214 to 1294. Bacon is a fabulous scientist, the origin of the scientific method. Although in this period he still hadn't reached the scientific observational rigor of Galileo, but Bacon pushed forward systematic observation and experiments on which to base conclusions. In this, he practically stood alone in the age of darkness, in which the blind adherence to the conservative ideals and the lack of independent thoughts were an overarching norm. In July 1264, Bacon observed comet number C/1264, okay, N for the nth half of the month, one, the first one he saw. Obviously, people weren't recording too many, right? A bright comet visible in Leo, Cancer and Gemini. He picked up the comet's stay in Cancer and how long it was moving and how it was moving towards Mars in the sky. Because of Mars' nature as a god of war, Bacon believed the comet signified a coming war and the general chaos in England, Spain, Italy and other countries. A medieval hanger-on, although he lived more than two centuries later, was the German monk and seminal figure of the Protestant Reformation. I wonder who he'd be. Martin Luther. Luther went so far as to write, "The heathen write that the comet may rise from natural causes, but God creates not one that does not foretoken a sure calamity." He called comets harlot stars and works of the devil. What? Yeah, it just doesn't get better. In 1578, Lutheran Bishop of Marburg, Germany, Andreas Celsius wrote a passage in the Theological Reminder of the New Comet, which summarised much of the thinking about comets during the latter period of the Middle Ages. "Of comets, humans and gods," he wrote, "a thick smoke of human sin rising every day, every hour and every moment, full of stench and horror before the face of God and becoming gradually so thick as to form a comet. With curled and plaited tresses, which at least is kindled by the hot fiery anger of the supreme heavenly judge. Wow. At the time, everyone believed that comets were caused by mortal sins, but Western culture produced staggeringly little progress in the thinking about comets over the centuries. This situation could only give way to the first glimpse of slight change around 1264. Flashes of intellectual projects began to emerge with a French Dominican philosopher called Gilles of Lessines, a student of St. Thomas Aquinas. Great person. So if you really know the influence of St. Thomas Aquinas and the whole of scientific thinking is amazing. In 1264, Agdeus observed C1264N1 and began to think logically about what he was seeing. The comet was visible in the evening sky after sunrise, then it crossed over in the morning sky. Before this time, observers believed comets seen in two different sides of the sun, even separated by small time intervals, were separate physical objects. Agdeus believed he saw the same object, simply in motion. Then along came the Italian astronomer, mathematician Paolo del Pozzo Toscalini. In the 15th century, the intrepid observer began to expand the thinking of comets, carefully observing six comets, 1433, 1449, 1456, 1457, and 1472. The comet he observed in 1456 was an early apparition of Halley's Comet, but the insight produced by Toscanelli would be lost for history for four centuries. His manuscripts notebooks were uncovered sitting in the Italian National Library, lay undiscovered until they were found in 1864. Among his papers were carefully drawn solar charts in which Toscanelli traced the position of comets relative to stars, perhaps the first to be careful to measure the distances and angles. In the same century, Austrian astronomer, mathematician George von Purbach observed the 1456 apparition of what would turn out to be Halley's Comet. He became the first astronomer to attempt to measure the distance comet of parallax. This is the way that you and I judge about how things far away things are. By having two eyes, he's had two positions on Earth. Viewing the comet simultaneously from different locations on Earth by calculating the angles of motion and deriving the distance. At the time, the young scientist, who would die well before his time, was a teacher at the University of Vienna. He studied planetary motions and believed that, as Aristotle had, that comets were a hot exhalation of the Earth. His balance measurement concluded that the comet was more than 1,000 German miles above the Earth's surface. One of Petriot's students, that's got a massive parallax. Okay, the closer something is, the greater the parallax is. One of Petriot's students was a young fellow named Jonas Müller of Kronzberg, also known as Regiomontanus, a German mathematician and astronomer. Regiomontanus popularized the method pioneering by Purchas of determining cometary distance by parallax. Although he died early, as did his teacher, and may have been poisoned, his works pushed forward the concept of analyzing comets by observation and mathematics. As the 16th century dawned, the Europeans cooked up novel ways in which to consider comets. Italian mathematician, astrologer, and physician Girolamo Cardano took on comets in one of his many research areas. So he's from quantum astrologer, great, great man, person who discovered imaginary numbers and probability. Just a really interesting man. An astrologer, just pretty amazing. He investigated comets like Comet 1532 R1. Rather than using parallax measurements, he simply noted the comet must be distanced because it's travelling more slowly than the moon. Later in life, he imprisoned analogously to Galileo, but for him, it was for having cast the horoscope of Jesus of Nazareth and claiming that his life's highlights were predetermined by the movement of the stars. that's really technically incorrect, but it's, you know. Cardinaux wrote about comets in his work Of Subtlety in 1552 and Of Variety in 1559. He believed comets were like globes excited into glowing from sunlight, and in fact, like lenses, the tails shone the sunlight passing through the comet, which focused the sunlight and thus created a tail behind the nucleus. Comets appeared during periods when the air was dry and signified corruption, famine, and death. Oh dear. One of the great greats of the entire history of astronomy, Polish astronomer Nicholas Copernicus, wow, he's got to do something good, originated the idea of the heliocentric universe, briefly treated comets in some of his writings. So Copernicus didn't have elliptic orbits, he had circular orbits, but he had circular orbits going around the sun. The revolutions, in his important treatise, 1543, Treatise on the Revolution of Heavenly Spheres, he mentioned comets assuming they were terrestrial objects and believing their motions reflected those of the daily rotation of spheres. It is said, he wrote, that the highest region of air flows in celestial motion. It's demonstrated by those stars that suddenly appear. I mean those stars that the Greeks call cometae, or prognate. So I forgot what the actual meaning of the word comet was, but the highest region is considered a place of generation, and just like other stars, they rise and set. We can say this part of the air is deprived of terrestrial motion because of its great distance from the Earth. Wow. Soon after the time of Copernicus, the Great Comet of 1577 V1, V for the half month, would have a profound effect on the cometary investigation. As we've seen, comets would be the first such object known to exist outside the Earth's atmosphere. The views of Aristotle, which had stood the test of nearly two millennia, were shattered. But it was significant for other reasons too. The comet was enormously bright, rivaling Venus. A number of astronomers in a variety of places measured the Great Comet of 1577. The first to make known his results known, however, was the German astronomer Michael Maestlin. Where others had failed, Maestlin succeeded by simple cleverness. He employed a thread to observe a comet and aligned its position with two neighbouring stars. Keeping them all on the same great circle, he then repeated the process with other sets of stars. Finally, he referred to voluminous star catalogue and Copernicus' masterwork, noting the star's position and connecting the pairs of stars. He repeated the process every few hours. In this way, Maestlin noted the movement of comets relative to the stars. Pretty smart guys. He observed the comet in this way from late November 1577 through to early January 1578, and developed a hypothesis explaining the comet's motion. Hopefully this will be good. His idea was that the comet moved in a circular path outside the orbit of Venus. He invoked the old idea of epicycles to explain the small differences in the observation theory. Although the comet's orbit was parabolic, he held a belief of its circular form. His idea could, for the first time, more or less explain the comet's motion. The Danish nobleman astronomer Tycho Brahe, whom we have met before, was obsessed with the Great Comet of 1577. Tycho had famously observed the supernova in 1572. So you have a star in the sky and it blows up, you've got a problem. And just 2 years before the comet's appearance, Tycho had established a handsomely funded observatories at Uhrenburg and Sternburg on the Island of Heaven. The Island of Ven. It's really interesting that this is the Hamlet that's written about this. Incredibly richly funded, Tycho was an astronomer's paragraph. On the evening of the 13th, 1577, He was in a pond catching fish for dinner when he suddenly spied a comet in the sky. He observed the comet furiously for the next 2.5 months. From his measurements, Tycho concluded the comet must be at least at 250 Earth's radii away from the surface. That is interesting. Okay. His figure for the moon was 52 Earth radii. Now, the Earth radii is 6,000 kilometres. The moon is 40... was it? 3... 10 to 8... is 30, around 40,000. Yeah, that's about right. Okay. He recorded observations of detailed comet faithfully, calling the head whitish and satin-like in colour and describing the detail, the tail as a reddish, darker colour similar to the flame when viewed through a cloud of smoke. For all the scientific description and calculation, Tycho still attributed the future events of the Earth to the celestial visitor. Although this comet appeared in the west and will realise its greatest significance on those lands that lie towards Earth, he wrote, it will also spew venom over to the lands that lie eastward and to the north, for its tail swept thence. Tycho's significant work of comet of 1577 is published in 1588 with the short title of The World. Tycho published his parallax determination of the comet in this work, and one of the barriers to understanding comets that stood for what seemed like unending centuries was finally removed. Yeah, if you're in the process of getting your funding to proper states, you definitely keep on saying things that would do that. The view of how comets were perceived from antiquity up to the Middle Ages would be incomplete if totally centred on Europe, however. The Asian astronomer observed the sky extensively as long ago as did the Europeans. China, in particular, deserved a reputation of being a hotbed of skilled observers who made frequent analytical observations of comets along with sky phenomena. Ah, right. Now, what's it? The Chinese called a broom. I forgot what the origin of the word comet is. I'm just... oh, hair. Comet, it's hairy. And the Romans and the Chinese. Chinese astronomers tended to be philosophers who were supported openly and living in accordance with their rules. This is a really important thing, that they were part of the ruling system rather than people who were a bit away from it so that they could actually bargain with it. Even in antiquity, when the Europeans were more oriented to theoretical conceptualization, great energy was put into great thinking, the Chinese astronomers were more focused on observing itself. The practice of Chinese astronomy was more centered on collecting observations than on preemptively hypothesizing explanations. As a result, the Chinese did not have dominating ideas of circular orbits and cycles and spheres that the early Greeks and Romans had. Chinese observers focused on celestial coordinate system of rotation around the poles, very similar to the modern celestial sphere. They were not limited in scope by the sun's apparent motion across the sky, as Greeks were, or by the overarching concept of altitude and azimuth, as the Arabic astronomers were. The Chinese divided the heavens into asterisms, not in the modern sense, but equivalently to today's constellations. In the 3rd century, Chinese astronomers recorded 283 asterisms in the sky, more than three times the modern times of constellations. So they divided up the sky into little points. It's almost like acupuncture of the sky. During the excavation of a large Han tomb in Mawangdi site of Changsha, China, in 73, archaeologists found a manuscript in silk pages with voluminous notes about the nature containing 250 drawings. The book detail titled Definition by Astrological and Metallurgical Phenomena dates to 168 BC, and the composition of the work has been traced to 200 BC. 29 of the book's drawings represent comets or broom stars, the form of the earliest surviving human representation of comets known. For the 29 forms or shapes of comets, they recorded the order of revised corresponding omens for each. These included perishing the states, a year-long war, disease of the world, revolt of the army, raising of arms and famine, a bumper harvest, but accompanied by war, calamity of the state, a five-day rebellion, death among generals, three small battles along with seven larger ones. Clearly, a predilection to warfare and a fear of political instability were dominant themes. Observationally, Chinese astronomers were sharp. They became the first to notice and record the fact that the cometary trails point away from the sun, except for anti-tails, whatever they are, and they may have been recorded the observation of anti-tails. In 635, Chinese astronomer and mathematician Li Chengfeng penned the astronomical portion of a voluminous history of the Book of Jin, the official historical text treating the Jin dynasty, which lasted from 265 to 420. The work published in 648. In the book, Chengfeng wrote about comets. Among the ominous stars, the first are Xuxiang, he wrote. Commonly known as broom stars, the body is as a sort of star, while the tail represents a broom. Small comets measure several inches in length, but larger ones may extend across the entire heavens. The appearance of comet predicts military activities and great floods. Brooms govern the sweeping away of old things and the assimilation of new. A comet can appear in any one of the five colours depending on the essence of one of the five elements which are given birth to it. According to official astronomy, Chengfeng continued that the body of the comet itself is non-luminous but derives its light from the sun. So when it appears in the evening, it points towards the east, and while in the morning, it points towards the west. If in south or north of the sun, the tail always points following the same direction as the light of the sun, and then suddenly fades. The length of the ray measures the calamity foretold by the comet. Later official histories and subsequent Chinese dynasties introduced additional cometary forms and their associated omens. Observationally, the Cheng Gen seems to have referred to comets with two horns or tails, presumably both sides of the nucleus, therefore referred to an anti-tail. These forms of comets were reported by the Chinese observers who spied comets in 467 and 886. As would be, as the world inched away out of the dogmatic Middle Ages and began to see the Renaissance and the Age of Enlightenment, work on astronomy on the comets in particular flourished, along with many other sciences. When the last great naked eye astronomer Tycho Brahe died in 1601, the event marked not only the onset of telescopic astronomy, but also the passing of Tycho's torch to his assistants. At the end of Tycho's life in Prague, German mathematician and astronomer Jonas Kepler served as Tycho's right hand. One of the things is that Kepler was predatory and waited for Tycho Brahe to steal all his work, but let's go into it. Kepler is best known for his three laws of planetary motion. This is the orbit, the ellipse, the area swept out by ellipse, and all that type of stuff. T squared on R cubed. I have to remember it. Kepler correctly described the orbits of such bodies as ellipses, with the sun at the centre of one of the foci. How a line joining the planet and the sun sweeps out equal areas during intervals of time, and how the square of the orbital period of the planet is directly proportional to the cube of the semi-major axis of the orbit. Yeah, I sort of removed that one. Published in 1609, the first two laws, and 1619 the third, the systematic thought of Kepler liberated the astronomy world from the cumbersome incarnation of circles, spheres, and epicycles that had persisted since the day of Aristotle. Kepler was not only a theoretician, however, but also an energetic observer. His thinking on comets would evolve from an early age. Many years after the fact, he wrote a letter describing how, when he was just 6 years old, his mother had taken him outside to view the great comet of 1577. Oddly, other than the German astronomer Michael Maslin, who still observed the 1577 comet, later became Kepler's teacher at Tewtberg. In 1602, when Kepler was 31 and several years past publishing his first major astronomical work, The Cosmographic Mystery, he had come to believe comets were ephemeral, rocket-like objects with straight-line paths. Oh my God! In 1604, the optical part of astronomy, Kepler wrote about comets. Strangely, though, he had been taught by Maslin, who believed in circular orbits of comets. Kepler never wavered in his peculiar belief that there were straight-line paths. He could not accept comets as objects that warranted permanent inclusion in the celestial sphere. They had been temporary nuisances. Kepler even outlined a careful experiment he had conducted in a dark room, shining a light onto a water-filled balloon or globe to reduce the reflected beam of similar light to a comet's tail. He believed light passed through the head and was reflected somehow towards the observer, creating a tail effect. Kepler's next work on comets was a popular writing he produced in the wake of observing for several weeks the comet of 1607, Shenet v. Halley's Comet. He viewed the comet on each possible night in Prague while standing on the bridge spanning the Moldau River. He published the observations in 1619 in the work of three lists of comets. Kepler summarized the comets and came about spontaneously from impurities or fatty globules in the ether. He believed that special spirit guided comets through space, and space was filled with innumerable comets, which could only be seen when they approached very close to Earth. Go Kepler. It's not that fatty globules. The great scientist also offered further explanations for the formation of cometary tails. He also proposed that sunlight entered the comet's head, pushing apart its head away from the sun, and drew out and created a tail. That began to dissipate the comet when the comet faded away and was gone when the material ran out anyway. But this was not equivalent to saying the radiation pressure pushed the particles away from the sun. The non-linear forms of the comet tail could be explained by refraction, not because the tail was actually curved. He also stated that the Earth should have contact with the portion of the tail. The result of living beings would be disastrous. Simultaneously with Kepler's cometary adventures in Prague, Italy hosted another clever fellow, physicist, astronomer, and mathematician Galileo. Wow, well, let's see what Galileo says. Galileo's career is so well known in his role as the first observational empiricist, so familiar that it doesn't bear repeating here. Suffice it to say that when he heard about commonly available hand telescopes invented by the Dutch landscaper that was for sale in the cities of Paris, he was horrified. Driven by the need for money, ambition, and knowledge, Galileo treasured the concept of the telescope because he knew that it would be highly valuable by the Doge of Venice, whose approval and funds he thought. Rushing to the workshop in Padua, he reinvented the telescope and simply on the basis of what he had heard, and by the fall of 1609 he was testing it. One evening Galileo climbed to the rooftop and moved his field of view of his simple times 3 telescope to the church steeple near the house of which the moon made its first ever influential telescope observation of an astronomical body. A new era of science was born, lauded as one of the great figures of science by some, Carl Sagan included. Galileo was outright to be called the father of science. When three bright comets appeared in 1681 V1, 1618 W1, so we'll see the system of letting really working here. Observers in the world took note and watched them carefully. Such was not the case for Galileo, however, who had time bedridden with arthritis and double hernia. Not so with the Italian Jesuit mathematician Grassi, who observed the comets in 1619, anonymously wrote three comets of the year 1618. Grassi forwarded his work, abandoning the ordinary astrological fears on comet and supporting Tycho's stand on cometary explanation. He supported comets as distant objects based on parallax measurements, suggested they move in great circular orbits, and imagined that shone by reflected sunlight, where they were travellers of great distance to the moon and the sun, indicated by the immediacy of the heavens. Galileo, being bedridden, participated in the great discussion over the three bright comets by listening to his students Mario Giudice, who penned a detailed treatise on comets, Discourse on Comets. Although it appeared in Giudice's name, it was essentially the work of Galileo. Rather than representing his own ideas, however, Galileo took the opportunity to attack Grassi. What? Galileo took sharp aim. He suggested that comets were not periodic. He described how the only other bright comet that would rival the brightest comet of 1681 was the comet of 1577, and those two could not be the same object. This comet would not have travelled a single degree over 40 years, Galileo underscored. Galileo also questioned whether the comets were real rather than reflections. How could Grassi know the comet was more distant than the moon if he didn't know whether they were real or reflections? With his own telescopic observation as a basis, Galileo suggested that any enlargement of an object in a telescope is independent of distance. Therefore, Grassi suggested that comets were distant because their telescope's appearance was flawed. Wacko. Galileo also suggested comets were made close to the Earth's surface and more moved upwards slowly, causing the observer of the Earth to see them as large without a tail at first, made glow by sunlight reflecting off the cloud of vapours, and showed a curved tail due to the reflection of the simple perceptive effect. He also attacked Tycho on his cometary tails appeared to point away from Venus, blasting the disdain connected to when Venus's light could hardly illuminate a wispy body. There you go. It's really interesting to hear about this. Again, if you really add into it, you read what the papal scientists were writing. The papal scientists were the most clear-thinking. So the Pope's Council of Scientists were the most clear-thinking, logical group in this entire age. Okay, Grassi replied to Galileo's criticism by issuing a text titled Astronomical Scale in 1619, under the fantastical pseudonym of Sarsi. Grassi attacked Galileo for associating comets with the Earth, which he had not straightforwardly done, criticising the astronomer with the all-now-familiar argument against comets as products of Earth. If issued as exhalation from Earth and rising upward, they would be swept away by winds, which reflect the sun's light as rainbows do, and so on. Grassi then suggested the comets would move in elliptical orbits, although he did not believe in sun-centered cosmos. Wow. Controversies come and go, but this one stayed around. The next move was that of Giudice sent a letter, a rebuttal to the Jesuit scholar Galuzzi, a letter which openly published. Galileo fired the next volley in 1623, publishing the Assayer. Before addressing the present controversy, Galileo used a diatribe to attack the German astronomer Simon Marcus, who had claimed to see the four Galilean moons of Jupiter before Galileo did. After correcting him on that account, Galileo then claimed he had not denied the possibility that comets were more distant than the moon. He simply chosen a comet moving the way it did because it best suited his point. Tycho himself, Galileo wrote, among so many other disparities, chose to observe observations which best served his predetermined decision to assign a comet to a place between the Sun and Venus, these were the most reliable. And Kepler entered the fray, having seen the master attack, responded to the work to defend Tycho against the other critics, called Shield Bearer of Tycho and Bray, the Dame. Published in 1625, the appendix created for this work addressed the controversies that arose from comets of 1618. It also steps aside on the issue of the glass globe troping reflection experiment by Kepler and conducted in 1604. He proposed revised views for formation of cometary tails. The heads are like globulated nebula and somewhat transparent, wrote Kepler. The train of the beard of Ephraim from the beard head expelled through the rays of the sun is opposed to the zone of its continued diffusion. The head is finally exhausted and consumed. The tail represents the death of the head. Kepler also argued against Galileo's view of the tail curvature issue. If curved comet tails were caused by refraction of light, Kepler argued, then curvature would be slight and always point upwards from the zenith, and only when the comets were near the horizon. Kepler also stuck for his old master Tycho, describing the ridiculous nature of his work, assessing the Jesuits' refusal to adopt the Copernican universe. Kepler was shot back with the notions perverse, Corollis and best servile worse. So now, of course, Kepler said they went in straight lines and they were flat fat globules from the heavens. Okay, in the mid 1620s, Grassi's arguments were running out of steam. He felt so low as to even suggest that Galileo's argument of nature resulted from drinking too much wine, and joked that the secretary translated to wine taster. At long last, the raging debates ground to a halt. For some 40 years, the cultural standing of comets stayed a steady footing. In November 1664, Spanish observers found a bright comet 18 days before it passed perihelion. By the year's end, it would pass close to Earth 25.5 million kilometers, so the Earth's sun radius is 154 million kilometers, so that's pretty close to Earth, and it leads to a major round of observation. The brightest C-1664 W1 reached magnitude 0 and spotted a tail of some 40 centimeters long. It's close to Earth. Another dimmer comet appeared the following year. The appearance of the two comets and their brightest just 4 months apart set astronomers to work and produce publication Examen Cometary Science. The preeminent observer and theorist of the moment was an Italian-French astronomer, Cassini, best remembered for his namesake of the dark Cassini division of rings in Saturn. Cassini spent much of his career at the Panzano Observatory, a private facility in Bologna built by the wealthy astronomer Athesius. In 1669, he moved to Paris for a short time and later became director of the Paris Observatory. So he had a French name. Using the observation in 1652, Cassini suggested that comets were beyond the orbit of Saturn. He revised this, however, to conclude comets are similar in the distance to the orbits of planets. With this observation, Cassini produced a mountain of new work. He recorded the new concept in the last hypothesis of the movement of comets. So Cassini looks as though he's really, really getting there. Saturn, of course, we know that comets move in closer than Venus and all that sort of stuff. Cassini invoked the orbital system he was familiar with, Earth and Moon and Jupiter and four Galilean moons. Cassini then worked observationally and mathematically to find the central body the comet was orbiting. Here's the interesting thing. When the comet was close to Earth, he calculated the comet must be orbiting Sirius, the brightest star on the Earth, in the sky, in epicycles, and Sirius in turn was orbiting Earth. Well, there you go. Isn't that amazing? Okay, then the great comet of 1680, Kircher's comet, arrived. Cassini had to go with determining the orbital motion. Most still believe the comets observed before and after perihelion were separate objects. Cassini struggled with making the observations fit a circular orbit. He says the comets were restricted to a zodiac band similar to that of the planets. Another prominent observer, a theoretician focused on comets, was the French astronomer Azout. Born and educated in Rouen, he left for Paris in 1640 and became an energetic observer well before the appearance of comet 1664. After his initial observation, Azout produced ephemeris that calculated and predicted the upcoming positions of the comet. Azout plotted the comet observed positions on a large celestial globe and angled the globe to produce a horizontal circle, enabling the plotting of future positions. This technique worked exceptionally well and was also employed by Cassini. Okay, what would he do? Azut agreed with Cassini on the issue of C-1664 moving in a circular orbit around Sirius. Okay. About the same time, Louis XIV of France, the Sun King, asked for scientific research to be done on comets, fed up with the superstitious fallout from comets and how it might affect his young rule. He sought Pierre Petit, the royal geographer, to write an essay on the nature of comets, published in 1665. Petit, a rationalist and a good deal of work, served the public relations campaign against the irrational fear of comets. It's great how comets keep alive because they're so political. Right, comets and permanent bodies in large orbits that occasionally make their way in the vicinity of Earth and believe they perform a kind of cleaning of space, bopping up dangerous gases and other poisons emitted by planets and other bodies. So this is what he believed. He was a rationalist. To address the issue of how far comets could travel, Petit turned back to the argument of Grassi against Galileo. He concluded that comets were very distant because they could not be magnified in telescopes as effectively as as planets. Obviously, they're so small. You know, the planets can be magnified because planets are big, but okay. Reason mathematically that comets could spend a period as long as 1,000 years or more. He also believed comets would probably travel in elliptical orbits, but would not specify the centre of the orbits as the Earth or the Sun. A geographer studying comets had a rich history of astronomers and mathematicians preceding him, but it was unlikely person to be the first to predict the return of a comet. But that's exactly what he did. Petit took notice of C-1664, and the one visible in 1618 were probably the one and the same object. On the basis of the apparent orbital observation similarity, he traced the possible comets backwards from 1618 to 64 intervals. He also predicted the comet's return in 1710, taking immense pride in becoming the first person to predict the return of a comet. But Petit was wrong. The two comets were not the same, and in 1710, the comets didn't come back. Further observations of 1664 W1 led in other directions. Italian psychologist and physicist Borelli is a believer in Galileo's method of repeated observation and testing. Observed the comets for 3 months. He measured the comets via parallax and determined the comet to be more distant than the Moon, and based the calculations on the comet's orbit and assumption the Sun was the centre of the universe, and found the comet travelled was probably the elliptical path. Distance of the Earth varied over time. Because the Church's anti-Copernican bias, Borelli summarised the conclusion gingerly and published the results under a pseudonym. As the same great comet of 1664 that also produced the first systematic observation of a comet in North America. Samuel Danforth of Oxford, Massachusetts, was a man of many trades, Puritan minister, preacher, poet, astronomer. After 3 months of observation, Danforth published a treatise on comet titled An Astronomical Description of the Late Comet or Blazing Star. In 1665, a careful thinker, Danforth concluded the comet was travelling in a circular orbit offset offset from the centre of the Earth. Because the comet moved slowly, he assumed that it was more distant than the Moon. He measured the comet's motion and suggested because it moved faster than December, it passed close to the Earth on that day. He believed the sunlight passed into the transparency of the comet, refracted through it, and became visible in a stream behind the comet's head. One of the great scientists of the era, English philosopher and polymath Robert Hooke, also observed and spent time thinking about the comets visible in 1664 to 1665. He also did some background research by extensively analysing the observation of the Great Comet in 1577. He waited to publish any results, however, hoping to observe another brilliant comet that would allow him to test some of his hypotheses. So when the Bright Comet came along in 1677, he viewed it carefully, conducted experiments, and finally read his published findings. His work, published in 1678, titled Cometa, or Remarks About Comets. In it, he summarised the careful telescopic observations made of a 6-foot telescope, which he set up such that he could compare the size of the comet's coma carefully with that of a nearby pole supported by a weather vane. I love this. His conclusions were many. He believed the comets were solid objects made of magnetic materials similar to those residing in the Earth's interior. He suggested that the nucleus could dissolve chemically from the ether that surrounded it, and suggested that, like magnetite, or lodestones as he called it, the comet would become repulsive, confounding gravity, allowing the materials to stream from the nucleus, forming a tail. Matter would fly off the nucleus in all directions, be blown away at the sun because of the material's repulsive nature. So, who's this one? That's Robert Hooke. Yeah, this is Robert Hooke. So, again, so you get more insight into what Hooke is saying. Hooke also noted that because the shadows were not visible in the comet nucleus, it was possible the comet produced some light of its own. He invoked other bodies that produced light of its own, the sun, the stars, even light from a decaying garbage. Hooke suggested that comet magnetic virtue would wind down over time, pushing the comet's orbit from an arc closer to a straight line. He also mentioned the role of gravitation in the life of a comet. I can't imagine how various motions can, with any satisfaction, be imagined, he wrote. That's supposing a kind of gravitation through the whole of the vortex or column of the sun. I love this. By which the planets are attracted, or by the tendency towards the sun of terrestrial bodies have towards the centre of the Earth. It's really interesting because you look at Descartes' work and going through. At this point, the man is often regarded as the greatest scientist in history, enters the picture. English physicist Newton received a letter from his colleague Hooke. In it, Hooke stated his belief that gravity's effect decreased proportionally with the square distance between two worlds. His tangent letter followed led Hooke to believe later on that Newton had taken this idea for the famous inverse square law of gravity from him. Newton accounted that Hooke's own work for comet did not include any such discussion, and even the English architect Christopher Wren knew of the gravitational relationship before Hooke. This controversy aside, Hooke concluded that the comet 1664, by announcing that the comet showed no parallax effects, his simultaneous observations have been accurate. He did know the comet was distant. Like Newton, firmly believed in the Copernican universe, and beyond that, he could conclude little about the precise nature of the comet's orbit. The Polish, so that's very interesting. Polish councillor mayor Johann Hevius also excluded a great influence on cometary science during the period. Although he was born to a wealthy family of brewers in Danzig, he received financial support from Louis XIV as a patron. Hevius will later fall into controversy, a tragic fire, and ill health. Well, there you go. The first of the controversies rose over the positions Helvius published for the 1664 comet. Also, Pitt and others attacked him vigorously over using naked eyes observation for observing the comet's place in the sky. Helvius observed the comets telescopically, but made positional measurements of his eyes alone, not trusting the transfer between telescope field of view and the eye. This goes on. To much great extent, when subsequently Hooke and England's first astronomer royal, John Flamsteed, entered the fray to attack Hevius. Hevius. During the period, the controversy of 1676, Helvius was struck by tragedy in his observer Danzig, experiment burnt to ground. He had only a partial success in rebuilding the structure and repopulating it with telescopes that shattered the former assemblage of equipment. The loss of equipment and reputation hit hard. His health had declined, and Helvius died on his 76th birthday. Before the full force of the treasury, however, and by the end of 1664, Helvis was originally deeply involved in writing his masterpiece of celestial visitors, Cometa Graphica. Because of the probably interesting comments at the time, Helvis produced a synopsis of the major work entitled The Hard Beginner Comets. In this short work, Helvis announced the parallax of 7,000 Earth radius, actually 1/6 of the real distances. He proclaimed that comets, so we're, I don't know how many distances we are, we're, there's 100 Earth radiuses across the Sun, so 1,500 Earth radiuses from the Moon, from the Sun, I expect. Okay. He supposed that taking the Earth's motion into account was an important determining the motion of comets. Hooray! He did not account for the Earth's annual orbits of motion, and his calculations were flawed. He later corrected the discrepancy in his full work. Hipparchus stated that 1664 was the very close to the star Alpha Centauri on February the 8th, 1665, a date that was important in his calculation of cometary parallax. But other observers quickly pointed out that their consistent measurement, the comet was 6.5 degrees away from the star on that day. And when, 3 weeks later, the comet passed close to the bright star of, it was Beta Arius, not Alpha. Rather than admitting the error, though, Helvis launched a long defense of his unsupportable position. The matter went as long as a series of arguments in London refused to accept his observation. Still, much of Helvis published about comets was printed in a series of papers over 15 years leaning generously towards Kepler, he held great value for the scientific world. So Kepler, comets travel in a straight line and they're eating up fat globules. When it came to the progress in understanding comets, few areas could match the meaning of Isaac Newton's renewed interest in the subject accomplished by the comet that would come to be known as 1680 V1, the Great Comet of 1680, or Kircher's Comet. This is the first found telescopically derived, delivered a huge impact on the interpretation of comets, and as usual, Sir Isaac Newton was the forerunner of the progress. Newton observed the comet throughout, but carefully calculated details of its physical nature. At first, Newton believed comets seen in November, December, two different objects of different sides of the Sun, moving on rectilinear paths. But after seeing correspondence about the comet between colleagues Flamsteed and Edmund Halley, he began to ponder the comet seriously. On February 28, 1681, Newton wrote to Flamsteed that he still believed the November and December observation represented two objects. He offered some advice on what he believed was Flamsteed's erroneous calculation of observations with the same comet. Having moved to the other side of the Sun, he pointed out the magnetism could not be responsible for calling a comet to the Sun because the red-hot lodestone magnetite loses its magnetism, and the Sun was certainly quite warm. Newton argued that if observation represented the same comet, then it would have to undergo rapid acceleration and deceleration. That wouldn't make sense. But Newton also been using observations that were available, not all of his own, and some were flawed. When he replied in March 7th, 1881, Flamsteed corrected the erroneous observation and suggested the Sun's magnetism may not be like that of the lodestone. Newton held on, but began to convert the one comet hypothesis. He wondered why early comets were still visible passing around both sides of the Sun. 3 years later, Newton had come up with to accept the idea that comets travelled on a closed elliptical orbits. It was the part of the mystery of explaining cometary orbits that he set about producing his masterwork on cometary, on gravity. None other than Sir Edmund Halley underwrote the publication and acted as a publisher for his Principalia. In the last of three substantial books, Newton outlined a method for determining the parabolic orbit of comets. He employed identical observations that were evenly spaced in time. As an example, he provided the details for his analysis of the Great Comet of 1680. The method was still somewhat crude and relative to modern precision, of course, but now completely correct in the spirit of analytical approach. Thus, Isaac Newton had closed the loop on comets as objects of total mystery. A great deal of work was left until humans really began to understand comets. Fred Whipple was not quite born yet, but in the 1,700 years, philosophers and astronomers had gone from pure superstition and speculation on the nature of comets to a mathematical understanding of them in their place among the celestial bodies. Seneca had wondered on his paper whether humans would ever know whether comets were portents of stars. It turns out they were something else entirely. So I suppose the take-home view here is that Kepler and Copernicus, almost everyone, Aristotle, had them as hot rocks, rice gum. Kepler had them as bits of fat frying out. And Hooke had them as magnets. So you can imagine that Newton got it all out. So it's quite an interesting story about how crazy it is and how people just couldn't leave comets alone because they were so politically and culturally important for just lubricating the doom merchants who are sitting around in society. That's like our popular magazines. It's sort of like, I suppose, news polls. Comets were sort of like a celestial news poll to rumble and create unrest. So thanks for listening. I don't know how long this is a list. It was definitely a big effort reading that. I'm actually quite exhausted. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'm going to put it up. I don't know whether people are really interested in listening it. Bye. Bye. Thanks for listening.